Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Mueller report released to the public last week has spurred calls for more secure election systems and scrutiny of social media after revelations of Russian cyber meddling in 2016. The question now is whether and how the U.S. braces for more cyber attacks on American politics in 2020. David Becker is executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, a nonprofit organization that studies and works to improve elections. David Becker, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we grew up in a world where we thought we had the best election system in the world. It was impervious. That came about around until about 2000 when things started to go sour. What did the report tell us about cyber interference in 2016?
Well, the report largely confirms some details that we've already known for some time, that the threat is very real, that Russia attempted to influence our elections. They were supporting President Trump and they were opposing Secretary Clinton, that they were engaged in a massive misinformation campaign designed to affect the American voter. And then specifically with regard to our election system, that they successfully intruded into the Illinois statewide voter registration database for a period of time. We've known that for some time. They didn't change any records or delete any records, but they did gain access in the summer of 2016. We've also learned that they apparently, through an effort called spear phishing, where an email is sent that is meant to appear like it came from a trusted source, were able to affect a vendor and one county in the state of Florida. It appears that breach is relatively minor.
So there's zero evidence, you wrote, that any votes in any election have been changed, right? So some people might say, what's the problem? Isn't that what we worry about, or vote changing?
Well, I think it's one of the aspects that we worry about. Certainly, you know, we've looked at the 2016 election more than any election in American history. There's been more investigation of the votes cast than in any election in American history. Independent investigations have been done by scholars at the University of Michigan and elsewhere, looking at ballots cast in such swing states as Wisconsin and Michigan, and found no alteration of the vote count. But that being said, we've got two major problems that could occur. Even without that being a likely possibility. One is that Russians or others could infect the voter list in some way, which could make it very difficult for people to vote. There'd still be ways to cast ballots, but it could lead to long lines and frustration, and we want to avoid that at all costs. But even more importantly, the Russians really seek to delegitimize our own citizens' confidence in their democracy. They want people in democracies to not feel confident that their systems are working and that their election systems are working, that their votes matter. And I think on this count, they've been enormously successful by just intruding a little bit here and there and making it appear as if they're trying to intrude in all of our systems. They're really succeeding in their goal of getting Americans to doubt their own systems.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. No, we're not talking politics per se. We're talking about the technology of the election system in the United States. My guest is David Becker. He's executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. It's a nonprofit organization that studies and works to improve elections. And so much of our election process revolves around technology today. That's why we're talking about it on Tech Tuesday. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing, Ann?
Good.
Back around 2000, there was an editorial in the New York Times titled Gambling on Voting, and it highlighted how gaming machines in Nevada are more tightly regulated than electronic voting systems anywhere in the United States. Electronic voting systems are basically a black box. There is no insight into how the software functions, what weaknesses or vulnerabilities there may be, and no regulatory on the state or agency on the state or federal level has any access to this information.
Hmm.
I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you, Mark. David Becker, what about that? And besides the fact that every county is different or can be different?
Yeah, we've got a very decentralized system in the United States. But that being said, Mark's not wrong from the perspective that we did rely for a period of time on paperless electronic voting in a way that we couldn't verify the ballots after they were cast, of course, secretly by the voters. But the good news is that we've learned our lesson, and we're moving in the right direction. We now 80% of all voters have access to paper ballots, which can be reviewed and audited after the fact to make sure that the electronic systems are counting them properly. And it's very likely that we're going to be at or very close to 100% by 2020, as states like Georgia, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Delaware, who did use still some electronic systems without paper up through 2016 and 2018, they're moving to paper as well. So, for instance, for voters in a state like Ohio, you have paper ballots. Those ballots are audited, and we can confirm that the electronic systems that are reading those ballots by auditing a certain percentage of the afterwards have been operating properly.
I wanted to get back to the massive misinformation campaign you referenced that the Russians undertook in 2016. There's questions, of course, now that they're doing the same sort of thing. It's just sort of under the radar because we're not in an election cycle yet, technically. But how do you distinguish between what the Russians did when it comes to misinformation and what Americans do, domestic actors do, when it comes to misinformation? We could even talk about campaign ads, for that matter.
Yeah, you've really hit on a real difficult problem. The Russians in general, when they're spreading misinformation, they're very rarely spreading content that they've created themselves. They're usually using content that have been created here in the United States by Americans that they think they can leverage. You know, there are these fissures in American society, and what the Russians seek to do is take information that Americans are creating, amplify it, and in doing so, kind of widen those fissures into vast chasms to divide us even more. I think one of the best things we can do is just be really knowledgeable consumers of information. Go to only trusted sources. Make sure that we really question the source, question whether the information that we're receiving is actually designed to divide us even further. It's one of the real concerns I have when it comes to looking at the information about the election, election hacking in general, and whether or not we're ready for that. And to be perfectly honest, the states and the counties in the United States have been doing incredible work over the last 2+ years to secure their systems. That story rarely gets told, and it's important so voters have confidence that we can push back against that misinformation.
One of the things about securing the systems, though, is that they're continually, I mean, there's a continual threat, and I wonder to what extent, how far can counties, particularly poorer counties, we have a big disparity in Ohio. We have 88 counties. Right. Some of them have plenty of money, and others have very little. They can't afford to be replacing and upgrading and updating with the technology the way it is today.
You're absolutely right. There's no finish line in cybersecurity. We're never going to be in a place where we can say we're secure. We don't need to pay attention to this anymore. Mm-hmm. And Congress appropriated some money last year that went to the states, including Ohio, and they've been spending that money wisely to secure their systems. But we're going to need a much more regular stream of funding to be able to allow for all of the election jurisdictions, you know, from the most sophisticated, well-funded county in Ohio to the least, to make sure they can train their staff, they can upgrade their equipment when needed, and they can provide for other security provisions that'll make their system secure.
And then you mentioned the Illinois State Database. That the issue of who gets to vote is a big one, as you know. It's constantly being, you know, debated in the courts now. All the different kinds of voter restriction laws there are out there. But if somebody can mess with the database and make it a problem at the voting, at the place of voting, that's a big concern, right? I mean, ultimately,
right.
They did not succeed this time, but that they could even breach is you know, reason for worry.
So it's a reason to be aware and certainly vigilant, but there are protections that states can and have been putting in place. Backups of their voter list, monitoring of the activity and going in and out of their voter list, creating for better prevention methods, better security protocols for those who have authorized access to the voter list, for instance, the county boards. Those are ways that states are protecting against that. And even if there was an intrusion, that it would likely be detected pre-election and it would be and would be fixed ahead of time. But that being said, the states, the counties are going to need to be extremely vigilant about this and be ready for those kinds of attacks, because I don't think there's anyone who thinks that they're going to stop.
What about the companies that make the voting machines? How much oversight and regulation and security do they have?
Well, there's, in most cases, machines need to be certified by a federal entity in most states prior to being deployed. But to be honest, the voting machine market has been dominated by about three companies recently, and that's not a really effective market. What I think many of us are hoping is that there are more options in the marketplace so that savvier government consumers of election machines who are buying new machines will have more choices, can ask good questions about the security of the systems, the transparency of the processes, the ability to upgrade or swap out components as new, more secure components become available. I think those are definitely legitimate concerns that voters and counties and states have about the vendors and the voting machines. And probably the best way to fix it is through market forces with more and better options available to voters and to government.
I know that I'm trained, you know, in cybersecurity, not to protect myself, but protect Ohio State University. When we talk about that county in Florida that experienced a possible breach through the emails, they were phishing and snagged a couple of county officials who obviously didn't understand what the implications are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so much of cybersecurity relates to human factors, as you and many of your listeners know. And so it's really important that that we get a regular stream of funding in to provide for the states and the counties to be able to regularly train their staff, their workers, some of whom are temporary, mm-hmm. so that they can understand exactly what they should and shouldn't be doing. Good passwords, two-factor authentication, avoidance of spear phishing techniques, those kinds of things are really important.
And again, this is a never-ending thing now. This isn't like there's no time when it is ever we're ever going to be able to relax about this again.
No, you can probably schedule a day on the calendar every year to be talking about this, because mm-hmm. we're going to be talking about it every year as long as we're holding elections and as long as we're using technology. And we're going to be using technology in elections from here on out. There's no way that we could take technology out of the process.
Well, David Becker, thanks for talking about it today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
David Becker, Executive Director and Founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, is a nonprofit organization that studies and works to improve elections. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google Earth wants you to visit one of 31 national parks by way of your computer. Kristen Appenbrink of the Google Earth is helping to share this story. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Kristen Appenbrink.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
How were the sites in the project mapped? What were you trying to set out to do?
Sure. So we really, you know, National Parks Week is one of our favorite things on Google Earth. Of course, we want to share all of the parks with everyone, and we have a lot of great imagery of them. So really, with this kind of first set, we prioritize the ones where we have great 3D imagery, satellite imagery, or street view. And a lot of that is actually collected by users who get out and explore the parks and upload it to Google Earth. So that way, millions of people around the world can see it.
So how did you vet all of this?
We did a lot of research. We work with an internal travel team, and they did a lot of the kind of the groundwork in terms of deciding, you know, what are the really important parts of each park that we need to visit, and then kind of looking for imagery that reflects that.
How does a project like this differ from just the Google Earth Street View that we're familiar with?
Sure. So we really, I think when a lot of people use Google Earth, the first thing they do, obviously, is they fly to their home. I've done it. Everyone I know has done it. And you maybe look at your childhood home, maybe you look at where you live now. But what a lot of people might not know is that we actually have a really wide storytelling platform built into the product. It's really an educational tool. It's a feature called Voyager. If you're in Google Earth, you'll see a little ship's wheel. And in that, we have a collection of guided tours, games, data visualizations, you name it. And so we really just wanted to be able to kind of share the national parks with people through that venue.
How long did this take? So you was it all collections from users, or did Google employees also get out there?
So a lot of the any of the 3D imagery, that's all collected by Google, but all of the I think we're probably at about 50-50, I would say, in terms of what's been collected in Street View by Google employees. That's one of the things that we know people want to see and be able to kind of preview either before they go to plan their trip or to explore when they can't make it there themselves. And so a lot of it is collected by Google, and all those cars and people wearing backpacks kind of trekking the hills. But then a lot of it is also by users. So you'll see a lot of variety there. And I would say, yeah, we're about 50-50.
How long have you been working on this?
So Google Earth relaunched about 2 years ago. It used to be a desktop app that you downloaded to your computer. Mm-hmm. And we moved to be able to use it in the Chrome browser. And with that, that's when we launched Voyager and our storytelling platform. So we've worked with storytellers like National Geographic and NASA and Time Magazine and the History Channel to really be able to tell the stories of the planet.
Which parks? So I mentioned that it was 31 parks on this at this stage,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 31 national parks. Which were the greatest challenge?
You know, I think a lot of the some of the smaller ones were a bit of a challenge to think, you know, come up with. Some of them maybe have lots of paths that don't have specific, you know, this is a really dedicated location. So if you look at, say, the Grand Canyon, we know that there are many different viewing spots on the North Rim and the South Rim, mm-hmm. and kind of visitor centers and that kind of thing. But maybe something like Dry Tortugas National Park, that one is a little bit smaller and it's a little bit harder to reach. There's less kind of imagery of it, but also, you know, there might not be a different individual point to visit. So one of the great things about Google Earth is that we're able to kind of fly you from one point to the next, and it's a really kind of a beautiful animation to see kind of what you're flying over in the world. And so with Dry Tortugas, you know, it's a very small park, so that presents a little bit of a challenge. But you know, there's obviously great things to visit in all of them.
And how you chose 31 parks? There's 58 total in America.
Mm-hmm.
You and I talked earlier, there will be more. How did you decide which parks to do this first time around?
Sure. So we looked at the ones that were really kind of the most popular. And then after that, we looked at the ones that really had great imagery. So obviously, Grand Canyon is one of the shining examples of the national park system. And so there is definitely great imagery. Street View, it looks really amazing when you fly through it in 3D and Google Earth. And then also places like Bryce Canyon, that has amazing both user and Google collected imagery. And so that's what we really prioritized. We wanted to have people be able to see and feel what it's like to be in those national parks, even if they can't get there. And then, of course, we hope we inspire them to get outside and explore them on their own.
Are you going to be on the 31 that you have already rolled out, are you going to be building mm-hmm. on those? I mean, will the database build out?
Yeah, I think we definitely have that in our plans. Exact timing is kind of to be mm-hmm. determined. So I am actually, I'm originally from Kansas, and the national parks in Kansas didn't make the cut in the first round, so I'm definitely invested in adding a few more of those.
Okay, what are the national parks in Texas and Kansas?
In Kansas, you know, I'm looking here. There's actually there's more historic sites and historic trails than there might not actually be a full national park, but that's where a lot of the trails west started in Kansas and Kansas City. So we'll definitely have to look at and see what we can do there.
What are you finding people are shooting for here? I mean, where are you getting the most hits?
Yeah, you know, I think we're still pretty early on. My intuition tells me that places like the Grand Canyon and Bryce Canyon are going to be very popular. And one of the ones that surprised me that was really popular was the Everglades National Park. Mm. I didn't know much about it until we did the story on it, and I'm definitely excited to go visit.
Was anything left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, things that you'll get back to or things that just didn't make sense in the scheme of things at this point?
Sure. You know, I think we'd identified this kind of initial set, and we were able to get all 31 out the door. I don't know that there was anyone like that was left on the cutting room floor, to be quite honest.
Were some of them that you didn't get to because there wasn't a lot of material on them yet?
Yeah, I think there were definitely some where we weren't seeing exactly, you know, maybe it was not imagery that Google had collected, and it was user imagery, and it wasn't the best. So I think there are some that we're gonna reevaluate and see. But those were kind of not on our original list to begin with.
On a lot of them, I'd see like backpacks laying around and that kind of a thing. It's like people were really there doing this. It's not floating. You're not floating in the air. You're on the ground.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's really impactful about Street View is you can actually just see what it's like to be there. And I think that's one of the great things about user-collected Street View, too, is that you get a sense of what it's like not from kind of a Google perspective of someone who does this professionally, but someone who is just on vacation and really kind of awed by the majesty of it and wants to share.
What about sharers? What kind of response have you gotten from them with this?
From the people who have actually done
well, they've seen it now. What you're doing? Do you have more people wanting to share?
Oh, you know, I don't know. Actually, I don't know if we've had necessarily an uptick in that, but that's definitely something I'll be looking into.
What is the plan going forward to update?
To update these national parks, I think we'll probably look for another moment and probably do maybe a version 2 next year. It's a long process to get one of these in there, and we want to make sure that we are sharing the best stories and imagery possible.
And how often, I mean, as far as updates go, it'd be cool to see these different places in the winter versus the summer, the seasonal changes?
Sure. So I think that's actually one of the great things about just being able to kind of, once you're in one of these national parks, kind of what we call itineraries or tours, you can actually kind of jump out of them and very easily turn on to look at what other Street View is available. So if you click the little peg man in Google Earth, you'll be able to see all of the Street View available, and you can see different seasons and just kind of explore what's been collected. But that's a very good idea. I might have to steal that from you, Anne.
Well, I have a few every once in a while. and then is the goal to get all of the national parks?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an eventual goal. We obviously publish a lot of different stories, so we're really looking for kind of a well-rounded platform in Voyager.
Uh-huh.
So I think we'll maybe kind of do this for our national parks for the minute, and then look at next year what we might be able to add into it.
Mm-hmm. Are there other themes besides national parks that Google Earth is getting into in this way?
Absolutely. So we do a lot of fun games and quizzes. We recently launched a Carmen Sandiego game in Google Earth, so you can actually play the classic game. It looks like the one that many of us are familiar with from the 80s and early 90s. And then we have a lot of conservation stories. We love talking about different cultures around the world. One of my favorite stories actually is called This Is Home. And it explores different homes around the world in Street View, and it really makes really beautiful connections to kind of show you that, you know, we're really more alike than we are different in a lot of ways.
How do you monetize this?
Google Earth is not monetized at all. It's an ad-free platform. It's really, we want to be able to tell the stories of the planet, and that's what we're doing.
Well, I want to thank you, Kristen Appenbrink, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Kristen Appenbrink is editorial lead for Google Earth, working on the project of the national parks, 31 so far. You can find on Google Earth. Check it out. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides to simplify that for you. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Mortal Kombat is back in a new iteration with a new story arc that some say has improved the classic. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley joins us to talk about that and other tech and gaming news. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Mortal Kombat 11 doesn't have the same ring as Mortal Kombat 10. But
it
what's
doesn't,
new?
Mostly because you lose that great big X that just looks so dramatic on the last box.
Exactly. It just doesn't look as cool. But what about it? What's new?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty significant upgrade. There are a lot of people who are way more excited about this than I thought they were going to be. Mortal Kombat has been around for a really long time. And this is an attempt to really kind of reboot the entire game. There is, you know, all of the classic characters, a couple of new characters, and the same basic idea. You pick whoever you think your favorite fighter is, and somebody else picks theirs, and they go and, you know, kind of beat the stuffing out of each other until one of them wins. And the game has always kind of had hallmarks for being just unnecessarily violent, because it's entertaining to see. You know, kind of gory things happen in the middle of these fights. There's like an entire gameplay mechanic built around it. But what really set this particular game apart is each character has its own kind of in-depth story mode where you go through and you know, kind of explore the background of that character and learn more about, you know, where that character came from and what motivates that character, which is not the kind of detail that you usually get when you have kind of a starting screen of people that look, you know, slightly different in order to beat the stuffing out of one another.
It's hard to imagine they have much of a backstory.
Yeah, so, you know, this isn't something that, you know, you would normally get the backstory for some of these characters by, you know, reading something afterwards. You know, the creator had put some time into something that you would read in text form. This is actually a whole, you know, detailed video background that you get to enjoy as you, you know, play through the story of that character.
The story has improved, right?
This is something that was a big complaint on the last one was that, you know, Mortal Kombat 10 tried to have a story mode and it just wasn't very good. They kind of rushed through a lot of it because the anticipation was that the focus would be on kind of online gameplay and didn't really focus a whole lot on local gameplay where people are kind of getting together to play Mortal Kombat against one another.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty hard lesson learned. And it demonstrated in this game that there's a huge focus on, you know, giving people things to do when they aren't playing online. And making it so that it's very easy for friends to come over and play together.
If you know more about your character's story, does that make you a better fighter?
I don't think it makes you a better fighter, but I think it makes you more likely to choose a character. If there are two characters whose fighting styles are similar, you're more likely to choose one that you more personally reflect on. You know, someone that you appreciate a little more just because of a story that you kind of latched on to.
Who also can beat the stuffing out of somebody.
That's, you know, it's an important detail. If there's an insufficient amount of stuffing beating, then what are you even doing here?
What's the point? What about graphics? How's the quality?
So this is something that has been worked on for a lot of games, in particular on the Xbox. This is a game that's it's natively at 4K resolution at 60 frames per second, so it looks really good. I struggle to say that it looks realistic because I don't actually want to know how realistic pulling one's spine out of another person is.
Right.
But it definitely has some realish elements to it. But it's also, you know, that kind of cartoon violence almost that you get which for parents who are concerned can be largely disabled in settings. If you have a younger kid who wants to play these games and you would prefer that they not see all of the slimy bits everywhere.
Okay. You got to ease them into that.
Right. You have to get that kind of gore and blood over time. You can't just start off with it.
The characters, it keeps the classics or are there an all new, is there an all new cast?
There are a couple of new characters that I haven't spent a ton of time diving into, but the big focus here has been on classic characters, both from all the way back to the original release to some of the characters that made it into other games and then kind of disappeared for a few generations. And keeping in mind that this is a game franchise that's been around for well over 20 years at this point, there is a ton of different characters to choose from.
It's, you know, you and I talked about this before. There seems to be a big nostalgia thing going on. It's, you know, I mean, it's not like going back to the Beverly Hillbillies, but it's 20 years and people who started playing it back then are returning to it.
So nostalgia has something to do with it. That's certainly true. But I really think that this has just been an interesting year in particular for fighting games.
Okay.
You know, there've been a couple of them. Jump Force came out a little while ago, which is kind of focused on fantasy anime characters that are in popular TV shows all over the world. You know, they kind of built a whole game around that experience. And there have been a couple others in the Street Fighter universe that have come out. It's just been a really interesting year for bringing these kind of dynamic fighting games to the front, you know, instead of what we normally see with kind of online shooters and things like that.
Okay. There are some deaths in the family, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, this goes back to the whole backstory thing. There are definitely some experiences where as you follow those storylines, there's opportunity for things to be, you know, kind of sad and in some cases kind of outrage inducing. There is one character in particular who travels back in time and beats the stuffing out of slave owners because that was how his character was built. And that caused some curious outrage. You know, so there's definitely death in some backgrounds for family members. If you travel into some storylines, there will be some characters who in the story die, but you can continue to play them, you know, through multiplayer combat and things like that. So there's a lot of different things going on as far as the story in this game, which, again, is kind of unusual.
And then the tutorials better. How important are tutorials these days?
Well, it really all depends. Tutorials are one of those things where if your goal is mastery in this particular setup, if you want to be able to do things like maybe play in local tournaments and things like that, then being able to learn kind of the ins and outs of how those characters work is a lot of fun. If you are someone like me who lives in a house full of people that learned from the school of button mashing, and it doesn't really matter how much training you do because your partner is just going to smash the X button until you die anyway,
exactly.
Then it's not really the same gameplay experience as you would get in kind of a tournament structure.
God, I feel so much better to know there are button smashers out there. I never read any directions, which...
Button mashers are definitely still a thing. My partner is happily one of them and definitely taught my son to do the same thing. And let me tell you, it's not at all frustrating.
Oh, boy. I have to talk about this. It's not on the list, but you and I talked about it before we went on the air, and that's that there's a new starter kit
for Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons, based on Stranger Things. I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's weird to get excited about a new starter set for Dungeons and Dragons. That's not a thing that I usually get to talk about on the radio.
Right.
But yeah, this is a whole starter kit. The idea is that you buy this box, and it's everything you need in the box to start a game with, you know, with 4 to 6 players, basically. And it comes with dice and some figures that you can use and some basic maps. But the entire mission setup, the entire quest that is included in the box and all of the visuals and figures are all themed after Stranger Things. So you actually get the Demogorgon figure from the, like, styled after the movie, which is funny because that character, you know, if you watch the show, actually comes from a Dungeons and Dragons campaign at the beginning of the show. But yeah, there's an entire, you know, set of missions that you go through in order to live the experience that goes through the first season of the game, essentially.
Yeah, that's not very technology oriented, but it's still fun to talk about.
It's not, but it is very cool, and I definitely bought one as we were talking.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I found it on Amazon as we started talking, so my kids are going to love that.
Oh, that sounds like a blast. Another game, Wizard Unite. Wizards Unite. It's a Harry Potter game, right? What is it?
This is the people who make Pokemon Go, which had just kind of explosive popularity over the last couple of years, have teamed up with Warner Brothers to make a new game that's going to come out later this year, and it's built in the Harry Potter universe.
Oh,
so
boy. The
same basic experience behind Pokemon Go, where you go out into the real world with your phone and you're kind of going to physical locations to do things and you're working with people to do things. But all of that in the Harry Potter universe. So you start off and you choose the house that you're going to go into. You learn kind of basic spells and you know, different things that you're going to do inside the game. This is actually being tested right now in New Zealand. So people in New Zealand can actually register to play the game and start playing, but it's not available to anybody else just yet. But it is this entire idea, all of the things that you remember from Pokemon Go, where, you know, people are kind of wandering the streets in droves playing this game. This summer, you can expect kind of a very similar experience with Harry Potter fans instead of Pokemon fans.
How smart is that they go with the Harry Potter? I mean, it makes sense on so many levels.
It does. It makes sense on a lot of levels. The first is that, from my gameplay mechanic, it creates a world where there are four different teams instead of two or three different teams, which is something that Niantic has struggled with in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just this massive universe where people are very excited to do anything that's even remotely Harry Potter related. And so if you tell someone that they can go out into the world with their phone and cast spells with their friends, I am positive that that's going to be a thing that happens quite a bit this summer.
Yeah. So, and people will, and also there's like some dress up that could get involved.
Oh, I'm sure that is absolutely, we're going to see people walking around in robes and hats and things. That is absolutely going to be a thing that happens.
Oh man, I love it. And then the characters in that game, I mean, is it just going to be everybody we already know?
So there's still quite a bit of information that we don't know. We have yet to see some of the popular, kind of main characters. I have not seen Harry Potter himself in the game or any of the other characters. You play a student who is going to the same school. So it is entirely possible that you could run into Harry at some point. I do know that in the training system where they kind of teach you how the game works, you are interacting with Hagrid from the books. So there is definitely some more, kind of deeper tie into some of the characters that you already know and love, but it's not clear yet how deep that goes.
Okay. You have now announced what the best Windows PC camera for 2019 is. It's Logitech Brio. Why?
Yeah, so this is something that took kind of a lot of work on our part. Webcams that you connect to your computer are weird. You either really don't care about them because you only use them every once in a while, or you're someone like me who uses them every day to kind of operate, with work and communicate with people all over the world and do a whole bunch of different things. And so if you're looking for something that is the highest possible quality camera that you can get for your computer, Logitech makes this thing called the Brio, which is kind of wider than a normal webcam because the lenses that are in it are a little larger. They're designed for 4K video, but it also uses some software that ties directly into Windows 10 for facial recognition security to allow you to unlock your computer with your face. And it also uses what's called high dynamic range or HDR to make sure that if you have a whole lot of light behind you, that it doesn't, completely blow out the images that are behind you. So it makes the room look a lot more realistic and color accurate.
Is that the 4K video?
4K video is part of it. HDR is definitely also part of it. Being able to mix the two of those is important. There aren't a lot of video services that stream over the internet that support kind of real-time 4K video, and it requires, kind of a better-than-average internet connection in order to make it work. But if you regularly use things like Skype, then there will be a noticeable difference between this and previous generations of even cameras made by Logitech. And like many other webcams that are kind of this higher quality, there is also a privacy shutter built into it. So you don't need to worry about, hanging a post-it note over it or something like that to make sure that no one is snooping in on your camera. There's a physical button you can push to turn the camera off.
If you're using a 4K camera, does the person in a video chat that you're talking with also need a 4K capable monitor, or is that not a thing?
No, so it'll make some details a little sharper, but it's not going to make a huge difference if you're video chatting with someone on a phone or if you're in some, chatting with someone who has a lower quality computer or something like that. That person probably will not see a substantial difference,
mm-hmm.
But it should be fine.
And if you have a Mac?
So Mac support will also do 4K for some things, but not everything. There's not quite as much software built into the Logitech stuff to work with Apple products, but it does still work really well.
Okay. And it's about $175?
Yeah, so right now you can get it for about $170, $175. This is actually down from $200 when it originally launched, and it's pretty regularly on sale for closer to $150.
Oh, okay.
So if you don't immediately need one, then you can wait a little while and probably find it on sale.
Are you going to get one?
I already have one, and it's very helpful when I do a lot of things.
Funko Pop. What is it?
So this is actually something, it's hard to walk into most stores in, say, a mall or something and not see these figures nowadays. This started out as kind of a thing for comic books and video games, but it has just exploded to everything. They are these little figures that kind of look like badly drawn, or not badly drawn, but very simply drawn replicas of your favorite characters, your favorite scenes from shows and things like that. These are collectible figures. And if you go into, a Hot Topic or EB Games or GameStop or something like that, you will see just a wall of these things. There are just so many of them that you can buy from just everything these days. And you can get them for all of your favorite characters, but there's actually a service now on the Funko Pop website where you can get one designed and stylized after yourself.
But it's only online, right? Or digital?
It's only online.
Okay.
You go and you get kind of a digital version of yourself designed in this art style. So you can go and kind of add designs to yourself and get, you know, the kind of this custom little avatar that you get for yourself that looks like one of the Funko Pop figurines.
Is this what people are putting on Facebook and stuff?
You see some of this on Facebook and Twitter where it's just, you know, kind of a cute way to make yourself look like one of these figures, these kind of highly collectible things. And it's entirely possible that at some point Funko will make it so that they can get physical versions of the ones that you've done, you know, kind of made and sent. But I imagine that if they did that, they would be pretty expensive.
Yeah. How much are they now? Just digital?
No, they don't cost you anything digitally now. You can go and it's just a simple website that you go through and do things. You can kind of poke around and make as many of them as you want. It's a free service that's part of the site, really to just keep people excited about these collectible figures.
It's kind of that free stuff to turn you into an addict kind of a thing, right?
That's definitely it, because Funko Pops are one of these things that are just, they're just so highly collectible that you know, it's very unlikely that you know someone who only owns one of these things. And it really, just because of how it ties into so many different shows and games and things like that now, like it is surprising how many of them there are for just everything.
Give me a sense of the range. What do you mean from what to what?
Oh, so you can get just about every possible Game of Thrones character, including, you know, dragons and things like that. Most fantasy shows, so, you know, Supernatural or any of the Marvel movies, mm-hmm. and TV shows or anything like that. A lot of the popular cartoons, including, you know, Pokemon, tons of video games from the hyper-realistic like Halo down to the very simple like Cuphead. There are just this massive range across so many different shows and movies and games that you can get these figures for.
And what do you use them for? Just
no, they just sit there. They do absolutely nothing. There are sometimes you can get special versions of these that are all kind of plated in a fake plastic gold as like special collector's versions. Sometimes there are variants of them that have pieces that glow in the dark. There are just a tremendous number of varieties that you can get, and it's something that every year the Funko people have become so popular that you can actually expect, especially around big events like Comic-Con, there will be limited collector versions that can only be bought at Comic-Con that are, you know, kind of specialized things that are available to attendees.
This is probably a stupid question, but have you been to Comic-Con?
I have never been to a San Diego Comic-Con. I have been to several other comic conventions that are pretty big. But the idea of that many people and standing in line for just actual days to see something is just not a thing that I'm excited about.
Okay. And is this something that where is Funko Pop from first? Where are they from?
As far as I'm aware, this is an American company. I could be wrong about that. But the whole idea there is that it's, you know, it's really geared towards this kind of global collecting phenomenon.
And is it mostly kids or not?
No, this is actually mostly adults, at least from my experience. They're sold in a lot of stores where kids can also get them. But the volume of accessories that you get, because some of these they go as low as, say, $7, and they can go up as high as $15, depending on the size and popularity of the model. And some of them are you know, fairly like statuesque in the amount of size that they can take up. But the whole idea is that these are designed to be kind of quick things that you buy two or three of at a time. And then the ones that you really like, you either keep in the box or you buy special collector cases that Funko also sells. So that you can have a clear plastic case for your little plastic figure.
Wow. You know, I mean, everyone said everything would go all digital, but we still like our stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, this ties into so many things that aren't even physical. You know, Fortnite, there are, you know, Fortnite versions of collectors that are special suits for characters that you have. And you know, the Fortnite universe is one of those things where, you know, new costumes are available every single day. So, you know, with the popularity of that system, they could just, you know, make these infinitely.
What are you looking for coming up in this week?
The biggest thing this week is probably some more information surrounding the Samsung Galaxy Fold.
Yeah, what's the deal?
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. The original review samples that were handed out to tech bloggers, we had a 10-day agreement to look at these and return them. And during that 10-day agreement, there was a bunch of problems with a couple of the models. Some of them were, you know, kind of silly user error things. Like there's a plastic cover that if you pull off, you actually damage the phone. And there wasn't like a sticker on it that said, hey, don't pull this thing off. Mm-hmm. So people accidentally broke theirs in the process. But some had actual display defects after a couple of days of use. And so Samsung is actually collecting all of them back at the end of this 10-day review period and is actually delaying the event itself, the launch event for the Galaxy Fold, by at least a month to kind of evaluate what's happening with this phone and possibly, you know, fix a problem if they can find it quickly before releasing it into the world.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Galaxy Fold is actually the screen folded in two.
Yeah, it was kind of a wild design where the screen folded and you had kind of a separate screen on the outside. So you had this thin phone that you could use. It was thinner than an iPhone when you were using it in this kind of small mode. But when you opened it up, it was like a tablet-sized screen. And it's a very cool idea, and it's actually one of several of these foldable phones that we're going to see throughout the year made by a couple of different companies. This kind of initial problem is making a lot of people who are very excited about this idea kind of thinking they should probably wait for the next generation.
Right, exactly. Wait for all the glitches to get out of it. Did you you had one for 10 days, didn't you?
Our team had a couple of them that we've been messing around with, and they're very cool. You know, as far as an idea goes, they're still extremely expensive for what they are. This is a $2,000 phone, and it was not that long ago that we were all kind of not certain about a $1,000 phone. Mm-hmm. So doubling that price for something that isn't fully, you know, thought out or polished is just a big ask for a lot of people.
Right.
So this is going to be an interesting thing that plays out over the next couple of months. And I'm curious to see what, if any, of these foldable phones actually ends up being something that people are interested in long term.
Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor. He's on every week on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for joining us for another week of Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.